offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai welcoming you to this week's episode of the Gita series, a program where we go through the Bhagavad Gita verse by verse and trying to understand and imbibe the message given there in the context of our modern lives, as well as in the light of Swami's own words, be it the Gita Vahini or the many, many discourses that Swami has given on this topic. And we are right now in the third chapter of the series. It's been a beautiful journey, to say it the least. The second chapter was a very packed and very comprehensive discourse that Krishna gives. The third chapter is one small part of the second chapter elaborated. And as we go through it, we see how important it is that those few questions that Arjuna asked were instrumental in Krishna giving this entire discourse on the third chapter on the Karma Yoga especially. And we can also see that a lot of the important aspects mentioned in the Vedas get covered in the course of this explanation. And that's very, very beautiful, because one of the themes which we've been going through in the past couple of weeks is the concept of the Yajna, which is generally looked at as a sacrificial ritual where you have a fire in front of you, incantations are made, oblations are offered, and a very rigid ritualistic practice is what is referred to as Yajna otherwise. But the same Yajna which are spoken about extensively in the Karma Kanda of the Vedas is explained in a much, much more accessible manner in this part of the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna explains what is that Yajna and what it comes to represent. And I think we've been going through that. And as always, I thank all of you for this opportunity, because of your company, I think I'm able to do this. And that's why this is a pilgrimage that we're all doing it together, and a means by which it's the bringing together of the three paths: the path of bhakti, not giving up the karma and all of it, to attain the most supreme of wisdom, jnana. And that's why it's a triune pilgrimage. And as always, grateful to the Swami and each one of you for this opportunity. Before we begin with the shlokas that we have lined up for today, let's start as always with a short summary of what we covered last week. We covered verses 10, 11 and 12 from the third chapter last week. In the 10th verse, Krishna says that the Lord Prajapati, the word Prajapati or the name Prajapati is used in that verse. He says Prajapati created this concept of Yajna when he created the world, and he gifted it to mankind, saying, may you prosper through this. May this Yajna be your wish-fulfilling cow. We had seen how this statement has overturns of the Purusha Suktam, where there is this reference to a grand Yajna through which all beings were created and created from God himself. In the next verse, that is the 11th verse, Krishna says that you nourish the gods through the Yajna, let them be pleased, and in turn let them please you and bless you. In this way you can reach the ultimate Shreyaha Param Avapyasta. He does not say, though he says in the beginning it's a wish-fulfilling cow through which you satisfy all your needs and desires. He says, but this process of Yajna, you propitiating the gods propitiating you in turn, will lead you to the ultimate good, Shreyaha Param. He says it does not mean only the worldly benefit, but this process can take you to the ultimate good itself. We then of course discussed what this means, propitiate the gods. What does that stand for? It is more of an attitude by which we do whatever we are supposed to do as our duty, and then offer our efforts as an oblation and receive the consequence of our actions or the results of our actions as gifts of grace from these deities. And we discuss how this methodology of looking at all forces of nature and all aspects of nature, like the rain, the sun, the seasons and all of that, as deities, brings about this duty-centric life and a gratitude-filled existence into picture. And as Swami has mentioned many, many times, these two are very, very important aspects of a spiritual life, a duty-centric approach to life, and looking at everything from the sense of gratitude. And how these two are interconnected too is something which I did mention last time. In the 12th verse, Krishna says that this way you fulfill your needs and desires and the gods will nourish you. But if you do not offer to them, but still partake of the consequences of your own actions and of your own deeds, you become thieves. That's what Krishna says. He says you become thieves if you do not make oblations and be propitiated in turn. And we saw what this stands for, what this represents, which it is not that you stop receiving from the nature let's say there is a farmer who is farming for some particular crop and he does not pray to the deities, he does not offer to the gods, he does not do any puja, he is practically an atheist. Let's say, does that mean that he will not have an harvest? Does that mean that his crops will not grow and he cannot gain from that? No, he will gain, but as we said, this is an attitude which we're going to talk about even further. In the absence of this attitude, you still benefit, but just like a thief, you benefit without deserving. You benefit without having offered or making yourself deserving to receive that particular gift of grace. So in that sense, you become a thief. So the verses that we are going through basically speaks of a very gentle and delicate balance in creation. And through this attitude of yajna, of offering actions as oblations and receiving the consequences as grace, it becomes a good way to fit into this particular cycle, this particular balance without disrupting it. Right? That's what the past few verses are talking about. In fact, the verses that we are going to go through today are also going to be talking about that. It's that importance of the balance that exists and how you fit into that. How you fit into that, you add to that, at the same time you benefit and you're able to come out of this cycle without being bound to it. Right? That's the whole process which Krishna is speaking about. So let's begin the verses that we have for today. We'll go to verse number 13 of chapter 3. As always, we'll listen to it in the voice of Brother Shyam, one of our alumnus of our university, and very, very beautifully rendered by him. We'll listen to the verse. I'll give you a brief meaning of that and then we'll discuss that in detail.
Yajnasishtashinas santo muchyante sarva kilbishaihi bhunjate tetvagham papa ye pachantyatma karanat.
The righteous who eat the remnants of the sacrifice are freed from all sins. But those sinful ones who cook food only for their own sake verily eat sin. So that's the meaning of verse number 13. I think we can clearly say that from whatever we've been discussing the past couple of weeks and the summary that I gave you today, that performing a yajna is being directly equated to karma yoga. And from all the explanations that we went through, the yajna being referred to is not a physical yajna, but the bhava or the feeling that is involved in karma yoga, or for that matter, even the feeling that is involved in the ritualistic practice of a yajna. So whenever there is this reference to yajna, it is a reference to that bhava or a bhavana, or that the approach, the mental approach that you have towards the way you perform your actions. So what are the necessary feelings for being able to perform this karma yoga or this yajna? One, this is a summary of whatever we have covered last week, a sense of duty, as Krishna said in the last few shlokas, the feeling of gratitude, and when one does anything as an offering to God, automatically one will try and do right actions. Right? And I think that's something which I will explain again. It's of course, we've spoken about it many, many times, how right actions comes into the picture. But Krishna is not only saying it is good to do karma yoga this way, but he is saying not doing karma yoga is a papa or a sin in this particular shloka. And now that is a big statement to make. Till now he was saying that karma yoga is normal, karma yoga is taking it one step further up. But here he is saying that those who do not perform the yajna, which means those who do not take this approach of karma yoga, are people who are committing sins. In fact, Krishna says, yajna shishta ashinah santo, those pious ones who eat after offering in a yajna, muchyante, are released sarva kilbishaihi, from all kinds of sins. Yetu pachanti, but those that cook, atmakaranat, for themselves alone, te papa, these sinners, agham bhunjate, eat but their own sins. This is a very, very powerful and very poignant statement that is being made by Krishna. Those that do karma yoga are getting rid of their sins, and those that cook for themselves and eat are eating their sins. I think many of the words that are being used here are very, very symbolic, very much like the word yajna itself. Here, actions are being equated to the process of cooking, and those that cook not just for themselves, but first for others and then take their share, slowly get all their sins reduced, is what is being mentioned here. So what is this sin that we are talking about? Is it the regular sin that we often refer to, the sins by which we harm the others, adultery, killing, or physically hurting someone? Is that the sin which is being referred to? Swami would often say that there are only four primordial or fundamental sins: ahankara, mamakara, kartritva, and bhoktritva. These are the only true sins, is what Swami says. What are they? Ahankara, ego; mamakara, the feeling of mindness; kartritva, the feeling of doership; and bhoktritva, the feeling of enjoyership. I think by now all of us must be familiar with some of these words because we have come across them many, many times. Now, when I do an act and expect the results, or I exult when the results come, or when I feel that I'm entitled to the results because I've performed the action, I am establishing my doership. I have done, so I have achieved, or I have done, so I deserve. As I mentioned before, the attitude of doership and enjoyership are twins, and this only leads to furthering the idea of mamakaram, or the feeling of mine. This is my achievement. These are my earnings. This is my house. This is my property. This is my family. This is what I have built. And nothing deepens the sense of ahankara more than all these feelings. But why are these four ideas referred to as sins? Swami would explain this by saying that this life is like being in a prison. Because once you go into a prison, you cannot walk out from there just because you want to, just out of your will, right? Swami says we all have been trapped into the cycle of birth and death like that. We cannot one fine day decide that I've had enough of this and walk out. There is a process. You should deserve to be released from this. And that is why Swami refers to this as a sin. I'm sorry, refers to life itself as a prison. And what keeps us in this prison, or what ensures that we cannot come out of it, Swami says it is these four sins of ahankara, mamakara, kartritva, and bhoktritva. Because that is what keeps us pinned to this many, many lifetimes, and that is the karma which brings us back every time after we complete a life. Karma yoga, as we've been seeing, is the means to reduce all of these mental attitudes that we speak of as the four sins. So when an action is performed as a duty, one does not seek the reward for it, right? Because it's my duty, I'm supposed to do this. It is expected of me. Similarly, when there is the sense of gratitude, it's a very, very powerful idea. We've spoken about it on many, many occasions. I don't know whether in this series, but certainly as part of the Answering Booth and other programs, you've spoken extensively about it. This attitude of gratitude is a very, very central idea for a spiritual life. When I do anything as a favor, I'm doing a favor to you or I'm doing a favor to society, I will certainly expect something in return. I will expect a favor in return, or I'll expect that I should be taken care of in return. But when I do something with an attitude of gratitude, the feeling is what I am doing is in return for a favor that I have already received. So when I do something as an expression of gratitude, I will not expect anything in return for what I am doing. And this is the same when anything is done as an expression of gratitude, even in the path of devotion, right? There is a very, very beautiful discourse where Swami says all the prayers that we do, the bhajans, the namasmarana, all of that should be an expression of your gratitude. It should not be an expression of or a means to please God to receive something. It should be an expression of gratitude, because when it's an expression of gratitude, you do not want a reward for that, because this is already me giving something for what I have already received. That is why the attitude of gratitude is so very, very powerful in the spiritual path. It's a very powerful tool to get rid of these four sins that we're talking of, right? So similarly, when I have the feeling that I am what I am because of the contribution of so many, the sense of ego expressed through doership and enjoyership begins to so slowly reduce. So when actions are done as a yajna, the sins are being slowly washed away. Muchyante sarva kilbishaihi. You are being freed from the sins. Because when, as I mentioned, all of these attitudes, the attitude of yajna, which constitutes of all of these things, remove these four things which bind us to this prison called life. But on the contrary, when actions are done purely selfishly, Krishna says you eat those sins, which only means that we end up reinforcing bhuktritva, kartritva and mamakara, and in turn all these three to ahankara. As we have spoken about even in an earlier episode, it is all about sublimating the sense of I am this body, mind, personality complex, which is ahankara. And that gets reinforced by all these things. So when the attitude of yajna is not taken up, when actions are performed not as karma yoga, that is when they bind. And how do they bind? They bind through these sins. So that is why this idea of looking at all forces of nature as a deity, personifying them and making them a god, making them a deva, is a very, very powerful tool. Of course, it goes without saying that one must go beyond the simplistic idea. Otherwise, we will think that if I don't do this, the gods will be angry with me. If I don't do this, this devata will punish me. You know, or we will entertain the idea that what is the point of worshipping this particular god? I worship the rain god, but we had a drought this year, or we had floods this year. No, this is a simplistic approach that we will take if we defy some of these natural forces and say that what is the point of me worshipping them? Because it is not the gods who punish. It is not the gods who really get pleased or angered for that sense. Let me try and explain this through an example. One of my colleagues a couple of days back was talking to me, and he said how his mother suddenly had this condition by which her face began to have a swelling. And they took her to the doctor. The doctor looked at her, did a few tests. And the doctor asked her, you know, when did it happen and what did you do before that? So then he went on to ask what is the food that you ate just before this happened. And finally, after all the questioning and after all the tests, he zeroed down to the idea that one particular vegetable or fruit, I don't know what it was, that she had eaten had resulted in this particular allergic reaction. So the doctor told her that, you know, just try to avoid this particular food item. I think your swelling will go. And that's precisely what happened. For the next few days, she did not eat that particular food item and the swelling went away. Let us say that after some time, she happens to eat that same food again. What will happen? the swelling is going to come back again, and it's going to cause trouble again. She listened to the doctor and felt better. And now if she disobeys the doctor, she will be suffering again. Now, is it that the doctor is being pleased and causing her relief, and the doctor is being angered that she's not listening to him, and that wrath is causing her to suffer again? The doctor is not doing anything to her. It is her own body that gives relief or makes her suffer, isn't it? So the system itself works like that. But the trust that she has in the words of the doctor becomes a very, very important tool to either find relief or to result in suffering, isn't it? Same is the case with this idea of worshipping deities and offering gratitude. They do not get angry or get pleased. The system is such that I end up doing karma in a fashion that it doesn't bind me when I offer it in a spirit of yajna. And when I act selfishly, it only binds me further. And this is not necessarily perceivable. It is not a perceivable result of our actions if we do not observe it consciously, right? Because this is a very, very subtle thing. Some acts have observable results. I cheat someone and I become richer. Me becoming richer is an observable result. And if I were to go by that observable result, me becoming more bound is what will result, but I will not be able to see that. It's not more obvious because I'm doing a sinful act. The results of the sinful act may not be so obvious. But if I were to be very, very conscious and observe my life, I will be able to find that, but it is not as observable, right? If I were to end up shoplifting somewhere, the immediate result of my act of theft is that I'm gaining something, right? That is the perceivable result of my act. But that also results in an unseen, subtle result, right? So some acts have observable results, but some have unperceivable, subtle results, right? Similarly, when I perform my duties diligently with the feeling that this is my offering to Swami, the immediate result could be that I don't get paid enough or my boss is displeased with me for some reason. But the certain unperceivable result is that my mind is being purified of these four sins, which will eventually lead to chitta shuddhi. And for this, for me to believe in this idea that if I perform my actions in this manner, it is leading me to chitta shuddhi, faith becomes very, very important. Just like how the patient's relief depends on the faith that she or he has in the words of the doctor, right? And the words, the doctor's words leading to the healing process is very, very similar to the benefit that the scriptures grant when they are obeyed. The scriptures do not come and punish. The scriptures do not come and reward. The deity similarly do not come and punish or reward. It is the system itself that functions in that manner. But we must have that faith in the words of the scriptures. And Krishna is going to hint at in the next verse where he explains the cycle in which this attitude of sacrifice and action is a part. We're going to discuss about this, how it is important to have that faith in the unseen to a certain extent to be able to enjoy and witness this benefit that we have. We'll go to the next verse, which is verse number 14. And I think it's a continuation of whatever we've been speaking. It's the same theme which is continued even there.
Annad bhavanti bhutani parjanyadanna sambhavah yajnyad bhavati parjanyo yajnyah karma samudbhavah.
From food are born the creatures. The origin of food is from rainfall. Rainfall originates from sacrifice, and sacrifice has its origins in action. So explaining about this particular part in part of the chapter in the Gita Vaini, Swami says, I quote that the statement which Swami makes there is very, very interesting. Swami says, Krishna taught Arjuna the origins of action or karma, the roots from which the urge to do action sprouts and eventually grows. Krishna taught them so clearly that Arjuna's heart was really moved and modified. End of quote. That's what Swami says. The detailed explanation that Krishna gave was so moving that Arjuna was first of all very moved and emotionally touched by Krishna's gesture. But Swami says it was moved and modified. In that moment of gratitude to Krishna, he says that he also was in a state to understand what Krishna was saying. And if you look at it, we all really can relate to this idea, isn't it? Once we accept Swami as God, and Swami has stepped into our life and he's proved without doubt what he really is, we acknowledge that he is the very embodiment of all wisdom. So if he says that we must act in such and such a manner, we must just close our eyes and act. We don't need to ask any questions. But yet, Swami has given hundreds and hundreds of discourses, thousands of pages of writing and innumerable personal interactions to fall back upon, explaining not just how to live life, but also explaining, taking much pains, why life has to be led in that particular manner. And as Swami would say, he gains absolutely nothing from all of this. In fact, there is a beautiful discourse where Swami was giving to some of the youth, Sai youth from the international organization, where Swami was speaking about the habits of drinking alcohol, smoking and eating non-vegetarian food. Swami said, these are three habits that I would want all of you to give up. And each one of those points Swami explained in detail, why it is bad. And at the end of it, Swami says, I'm telling you to give up all of these things, not because I receive anything for that or I gain anything by that. These are detrimental to your own health and detrimental to your own spiritual life, right? And Swami made it very clear that he gains nothing by us following or not following. Same is the case here. Krishna is going to gain nothing if Arjuna fights or chooses not to fight. Krishna gains nothing if Arjuna is going to perform karma yoga or he's going to perform mundane karma. If you look at it, we fall for all kinds of marketing and fashion and cool drinks and cars and etc. etc. We see some advertisement in the TV and we get interested in that product. We see an advertisement for a gadget and we think that that's going to improve our life. All the while, who is giving those messages? Who is making those marketing advertisements or print ads or whatever they are? It is being made by people who will gain if you buy that product or if you start using that particular product, right? But yet we fall for that advertisement campaign. But here is Swami who is speaking of something which he is going to benefit nothing from. You follow it, you don't follow it. Whether Arjuna follows or not follows, Krishna is not going to benefit. Whether we obey Swami or we don't obey Swami, Swami is not going to benefit in any way. But yet we fall for something like an advertisement campaign where we clearly see that there is a vested interest in the person who is giving out the advertisement itself, right? But this idea that there is nothing that Swami can gain is very, very important, because when a person can gain nothing from you and still he gives you an advice, it means if that person's absolute selflessness backs that advice, it means that advice is as pure as it can get. Just a couple of days back, I was listening to one of my classmates give a talk to a group of devotees where he was saying that on multiple occasions he had this opportunity to ask Swami this question, where he was very, very overwhelmed by the love that he was receiving from Swami and said, Swami, what can I do for you? What can I do for you, Swami? You've given us so much. What can I do for you? And he said, any number of times he's asked this, and each and every time Swami's only answer was, be happy, be happy, right? It was not that do this and make me happy and do this and give me this. No, he said, you be happy. And if you look at it, all of what Swami says in his discourses or the Bhagavad Gita for that matter is a manual as to how to become happy and happy in the true sense. Right? And that's what Swami is saying, that whatever I'm saying is for your benefit. In fact, it is this selfishness that gives validity even to the scriptures. Though Krishna is dissuading Arjuna from going away to the forest, it doesn't mean that Krishna doesn't approve of such expression of sacrifice completely, right? The reason why the scriptures or the words of great masters and sages are so valid is because that they do not get any personal benefit from anybody following their advice, unlike a marketing or an advertisement campaign, right? And that is what makes these words so valid. And that's what, as I said in the previous verse, why do we really have, in the case of a doctor, when I go to a doctor as a patient, what gives me faith in the words of the doctor? Probably the qualification which has been conferred on the doctor by a body which has the authority to do that, right? But at the same time, we imagine someone like a great sage who has dedicated his life to wisdom, right? First of all, he has the wisdom to advise. And along with that wisdom, he also has this renunciation and sacrifice by which he is going to benefit absolutely nothing by you following what he says. And such a word can be followed. And that's why when you have to believe in something which talks about an unperceivable result, right? When someone tells you that if you do this, it will lead to sin. If you do this, it will lead to merit. If you do this, it will lead to chitta shuddhi. That is not something that I can see in my everyday life. It is not perceivable. It needs a little more subtle and conscious living to be able to notice that, right? So if I'm in a state where I don't know which is the right act, which is not the right act, so whom do I follow? Whom do I listen to? And that is why they say that one of the most trustworthy pramana, or a means of knowledge, or a word by which you can lead your life, is the Vedas itself, because they have been given by people who do not benefit anything by you following it. We'll come back to that towards the end of today's program also, because there is a mention of how Veda fits into all of these things. But for now, we'll go back to this shloka. So in this shloka, Krishna takes on from where he left about food, right? In the previous verse, he said that those who cook food for themselves are actually eating their sins, right? So he goes back to that idea of the food, and he speaks about the origin of how, you know, the role that food plays in this entire balance that we were talking about. He says, Annat bhavanti bhutani. From food has come all beings. This is a statement that is true literally and figuratively too. This body of ours, if you look at it, it is born due to the food that was eaten by our parents. And then having been born as probably a mere 2 or 3 kg body at the time of birth, we are now this person who is at least 20-25 times that weight. And that is because of the food that we have intaken all through this lifetime. And this is a statement that we find in many places in the Vedas too. And that is why this body is called Annamaya Kosha, the sheath that is made of food. That is the description that is given to the physical body. And another place where the mention is there is in the Taittiriya Upanishad. There is this entire sequence of how creation comes to be, where it says that there is this pure self, from the self comes Akasha, or the sky, and then it goes on to say Akasha Vayuhu Vayur Agnihi Agnir Apaha Apya Prithvi Prithivyo Shadayaha and Oshadebhyo Annam Annat Purushaha, which means from space comes Vayu or air, from air comes Agni, that is fire, from fire comes water, from water Prithvi or earth, and from earth is born the herbs or plants, and from those come food, and from food comes man. We will of course not go into this entire sequence now, but we have spoken about this before. I think at least I've done one of my answering booth sessions on this, this particular sequence of the five elements, and how what is the meaning of this particular statement. Because again, this is not pretty logical when you say, at least the first time when I heard this incantation in Swami's presence, Agni Rapaha. Right, it says from fire comes water. How do you make sense of that? But this is a very, very subtle thing. We will not go into the details of that. I think this might come again in the later verses of the Gita. Probably at that time we'll dwell into that. So this idea, annad bhavanti bhutani, from food has come all beings, is a common refrain in the Shrutis. And that's why I was quoting those two examples. But if we go back to our understanding as food is the consequence of our actions, right? From the previous verse, I think that is the interpretation that we were talking about. When we say cooking for oneself, it means doing karma with the idea that I must alone enjoy the results. So the results or the consequences of the actions are actually equated to food. So when Krishna says all creatures are born of food, we can probably also interpret it as all beings. Bhutani means all beings that come into this earthly realm of cause and effect called Bhuloka, right? They are referred to as Bhutani, Bhutakanas or, you know, Bhutani or creatures of the earthly realm. And what brings any of us back to the world? Isn't it the consequence of our actions, right? That's what we spoke about, the four sins. It is the consequence of our actions that bring us back into the world. So when Krishna says that annad bhavanti bhutani, all the beings in this bhuloka come into be because of the consequence of their actions, is probably an interpretation which is not wrong to make. Then Krishna goes on to say, parjanyat anna sambhavaha. Food in turn comes from rain. Well, that is again quite straightforward to understand. But we will come back to that too. Then he goes on to say, yajnyat bhavanti parjanyo. And this parjanya or rain comes from yajna. Yajna karma samudbhavaha. And yajna has come from action. So the straightforward way is to say that food grows because of rains. Rain comes from yajna or sacrifice, and sacrifice comes into picture only through karma or action. But this statement, parjanyat anna sambhavaha, food comes from rain, can also be interpreted as sustenance comes from these deities or devatas, or the natural forces that are divinely ordained. And these, as Krishna said in the previous shloka, are born through yajna. And actions are those that lead to yajna. Well, honestly speaking, this part is a little complex and I would say a bit academic too. In fact, Swami has also not explained much in detail in the Gita Vahini of this particular section. But let us see if we can simplify it without worrying too much about the layers and layers of interpretation. I think that's what we're doing, and we probably will lose track of the interpretation of each of these words. The context of the shloka and the shloka that is to follow, or for that matter, this entire part in the chapter, is Krishna is trying to establish the importance of karma, right? And the parallel narrative is about karma yoga, which is the most ideal way to perform karma. And that karma yoga is referred to as yajna. I think that much we've established. So this is the context. So Krishna is conveying in this particular part that you cannot look at your actions as being standalone. They are literally like a cog in the wheel, a nut in a machine. You, by acting, are contributing to a larger balance, right? That is the idea that Krishna is trying to convey. And by contributing to this balance, you thereby also benefit by attaining Chitta Shuddhi, right? So this is the entire flavor of this particular part of the Bhagavad Gita. Now let us look at this verse, and of course the next one too, from the point of view that we have just established and the context that we have established. Krishna says all beings are sustained by food, right? That is the first point. That is literally a no-brainer, right? As we said, without food, none of us will be alive. Now, where does this food come from? From rains, says Krishna. In other words, with timely occurrences of natural phenomena, right? That's what it refers to. Where do we get this food from? Good rains, good sunshine, and timely changes of season, right? And much of the agricultural process is connected to all of the ecosystem, which is in complete balance. In fact, if you speak to some of the agriculturists, they'll say that It is also connected to the life cycle of certain insects, right, which could eventually end up destroying your whole farm. So all of this is very, very subtly and maintained in a very, very precarious balance, that anything goes wrong, you might have the entire year being lost out. And that's why farming and agriculture has become such a high risk profession these days. And you just have to read the Indian newspapers to understand how many problems we have because of that. So food comes from this delicate balance. So now the question comes, where does this balance come from? In the Indian culture, in the Bharatiya tradition, where there is this idea, we all must have heard it from our elders, this particular statement, and I think we all have grown up hearing this, you know, when they see somebody with a very good nature, when they see somebody with a very compassionate heart, people would say, it's because of such good people that we still have good rains in this country, right? I'm sure most of you, in your own local languages, Indian languages, you would have heard this statement being made by our elders. So there is this cultural belief that it is the goodness among people that keeps the balance in nature intact. In fact, even in the past, there would always be this correlation between the righteousness of the king who's ruling the land and the prosperity of the land, right? They would say that if there is a good king, he's a righteous king, he's governing his kingdom well, that particular kingdom will have good rains. In fact, if you read some of the Puranic stories, if you read the Srimad Bhagavatam, there would be, this mention would be there in multiple places. That's one of the ways by which they describe a king to be a good king. They would say that he was such a good king that there were good rains in his country and, you know, people were prospering in that manner. So there is this idea that it is goodness that leads to this balance in nature. In fact, there's this very, very profound conversation that I read sometime back between Mr. V.K. Narasimhan, who was a very senior journalist and later became the editor of Sanatan Sarthi and Swami. So he was an editor of a very popular newspaper. You know, being readers of the newspaper, we read so many disturbing news. In fact, just before I started this program, I read the news. I'm not going to talk about that. It was so disturbing. You know, you wonder, where are we all heading? You know, such unrighteousness, and not just unrighteousness, such demonic behavior is there amongst people that we live with, and we wonder, how can people really behave in that manner, right? We read so many such news items every now and then. So it must have been a day when Mr. V.K. Narasimhan had read some news like that. He came to Swami and he said, Swami, you know, the amount of sin that is happening all around the world, the amount of unrighteousness which is there, the amount of adharma which is there in this world, I wonder, how is it that Mother Earth has not given up and just disintegrated? You know, there's so much of adharma in this world that Mother Earth should have just broken up and given up on mankind. And I wonder how it is all staying together. And in response to that, Swami said something which was very, very profound. Swami said, you're absolutely right. That should have happened a long time ago. And then Swami said, you know, what is keeping everything together? What is keeping her still hopeful? Swami said, it is the devotion of my devotees, right? And when Swami says it's the devotion of my devotees, it does not mean Satya Sai devotees who have acknowledged Swami. It means all devotees of God. You may be devoted to Swami, you may be in Swami's fold, you may not be in Swami's fold, you may be a Muslim, a Christian, or whatever it is, an atheist also, but believes in the divinity of love. Whatever may be your orientation to the idea of God, if you are a devotee, as Swami would say, it's somebody who has this goodness. And Swami was saying that it is the goodness that comes from this devotion is what is keeping this entire balance intact, right? So this yajna, or this approach of doing actions selflessly, right, is what whatever balance and nature that we have is a result of this particular goodness that comes from that. In fact, Swami would often say this even in his discourses, that, you know, the natural calamities that we see in the nature is a result of man's greed. And the universe is, you know, and the inverse is that all the balance in nature is because of the goodness that comes. So as I've been saying, we cannot drop raga and dvesha and selfishness just like that. It does not happen by just we making up our mind to do that. So even if we are made to act based on fear and desire, we must act, right? That is one of the important messages that Krishna says. Karma is important. That is the bottom line. Without action, there cannot be selfless action. Yajna is important, karma yoga is important, but without action, there cannot be selfless action. Without karma, where is the question of karma yoga? So Krishna says, yajna karma samudbhavaha. Yajna or good actions or sacrifice, however you wish to describe it, comes from karma itself, comes from action itself. And that is what makes karma so important. So each one of us has two choices before us, to act or not to act. The animals, the birds, nature itself, the trees, the plants, they are programmed to continue to act. They don't have this choice of acting or not acting. I think we spoke about it last week too, that this conscious will has been given to humankind to be able to progress ahead, but at the same time, it can also lead to us falling off the track, right? So all of us have this choice. The first choice that we have is either to act or not act. And by acting in the right manner, we will be contributing to this entire system of balance. And by acting, we have an opportunity to progress from the human to the divine level. But this karma, as Krishna mentioned earlier, can bind too. So there comes the next choice. Do you wish to do karma or do you wish to do karma yoga? And by choosing to do karma yoga, we contribute to this balance and also ensure that we progress without being bound. But for now, in the shloka, Krishna has described the place that karma has in this whole system, right? This particular shloka, shloka number 14, is about how important is karma and what is the role that karma plays in this balanced system that he is talking about. In the next verse, he is going to continue that and he is going to backtrack and say, where does karma come from itself? So we listen to that. It's verse number 15. After we listen to that, I'll give you a brief meaning of that and we'll discuss about it.
Karma brahmodbhavam vidhi brahmaksharasamudbhavam tasmat sarvagatam brahma nityam yajne pratishthitam.
No doubt that action comes from Brahma, and Brahma comes from the imperishable. Therefore, the all-pervading Brahma ever rests in sacrifice. So further tracing the roots of karma, Krishna says, Vidhi, may you understand that karma brahmodbhavam. Karma is born out of Brahma. Now this word Brahma is up for a lot of deliberation by the many, many people who give commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita. It cannot be the absolute Brahman, right? The concept of Brahman that is there in the Upanishads and is often spoken about by Shankara himself in the Advaita philosophy. It cannot be that Brahman because the very next statement that Krishna says is Brahma Akshara Samudbhavam. Brahma is born of Aksharam. Aksharam is another word for the Supreme Brahman or the Atman. Akshara literally means that which cannot be destroyed. So what is this Brahma which Krishna is referring to in this verse when he says Karma Brahmodbhavam? Some commentators translate it as Prakriti or nature. Right? The word Brahma in Sanskrit can also be used to refer to nature. So some of the commentators prefer to use that. But Shankara in his commentary says that in this verse the reference is to the Vedas. He says karma, or what is one supposed to do? What are the actions one is supposed to perform? How do you know what am I supposed to do? How do you determine that? He says that comes from the Vedas. So some of them says that Brahma stands for Vedas. Some of them says Brahma stands for Prakriti or nature. Of course, so when in confusion, we turn to Swami for clarity. And in Swami's Gita Vahini, Swami very, very clearly states that Brahma stands for the Vedas. So in what way can we say that karma originates from the Vedas? We could simply say that the Vedas have the do's and don'ts of life and we must follow them. That is how most people look at it, and that is how people ended up being very, very ritualistic, right? Because the Vedas do talk in detail about many, many ritual practices, right? But if you look at it from that point of view, there is a huge population that is probably not acquainted to the Vedas at all. Can we say that all of them do not have the opportunity to perform Karma Yoga because of that? Now, I'm going to stretch this a little bit to interpret this idea that karma comes from Vedas. I'm saying this on the basis of some of the explanations that Swami has himself given for the later shlokas, for the concepts which Krishna speaks about in the later shlokas. So, but this is definitely a stretch of interpretation. The Vedas, if we look at them, they are not man-made books of rules. They are not like the Indian constitution or any of the constitutions of the world. They're not like a book of law. They are referred to as Shrutis, right? We mentioned this name of the Vedas many times. They are Shrutis, something that was heard, something that was received. So the Vedas are meant to be, are referred to as the breath of God that were received when the mind was stilled. So they are definitely a code to be followed, but they are received from the divinity within when one's own perception does not skew. One's own perception is not skewed by the mind, right? So in that state of stillness, in that state of meditation, when these great sages whom we refer to as mantra drashtas, or those who saw these mantras, those who saw these incantations, when they sat and stilled their mind, when they could reach that state where the mind does not interfere in the way they look at the world, in the way they receive the vibrations from around, in that state they received these Shrutis, right? So can we say that when Krishna says karma brahmodbhavam, he is suggesting that karma, or what karma is to be performed, that idea of what is right and wrong, originates from the voice of the conscience, right? Because that's what basically it is. When the mind is not interfering, what you hear, the divine word that you hear, in our day-to-day life, it is the voice of the conscience, isn't it? And when he says, Brahma Akshara Samudbhavam, it means that voice, which we refer to as the voice of the conscience or the voice of the heart, comes from Brahman, or the Akshara Brahman, which is the ultimate supreme being. So that way Krishna is tracing the origins of karma to the supreme being itself. In the next line Krishna says, Tasmat, therefore, Sarvagatam Brahma, the all-pervasive Brahma. Now this refers to the Brahma as the supreme, because he's clearly saying Sarvagatam Brahma, the all-pervasive Brahma. So this is to the Atman or the Brahman that we refer to as the Supreme Being. So Tasmat, therefore, Sarvagatam Brahma, the all-pervasive Brahman, Nityam Yajne Pratishtitam. Although this divine is all-pervasive, Nityam, although this Brahman is all-pervasive, that's what he says, Sarvagatam Brahma, it is all-pervasive, but he goes on to say, Nityam Yajne Pratishtitam. It is established in this act of Yajna. So Krishna is, in other words, establishing the importance of karma and also how the attitude of sacrifice or Yajna is an opportunity to root karma in divinity itself. Yes, karma is born out of this divine being and the karma is being performed, but as they see, there are many a slip from the cup in the lip. By the time the actions are performed and we are awaiting our consequence of those actions, it gets muddled with all of the selfishness, the idea of I'm the doer, and selfishness and self-centered actions and all of that. So in all of this, yajna becomes an opportunity to reroot karma in the divinity that it has its source, right? So that's what Krishna is saying. Nityam Yajne Pratishtitam. He says, this Sarvagatam Brahma Nityam Yajne Pratishtitam. This all-pervasive Brahma, right, gets established in this attitude of Yajna. That's what Krishna says. I know the time is up, but I would like to play the next verse. I'll probably just give you the brief meaning of that because it completes this discussion that we've had. I'll not go much into the detail of the meaning. I'll probably just give you that, a brief meaning of that, so that it concludes this idea that we're talking about. Next week when we start, we'll start with this verse and we'll carry on from there. So this is verse number 16 of chapter 3. We'll listen to it. I'll give you a meaning and probably we'll conclude with that.
Evam pravartitam chakram nanuvartayatihayaha aghayurindriyaramo mogham parthasajivati.
He who does not follow here the wheel thus set revolving, who is of sinful life, rejoicing in the senses, he lives in vain, O Arjuna. So that's the meaning of the 16th verse. Clearly, Krishna says, evam pravartitam chakram. There is this wheel which has been set in motion, and that's what we've been talking about. It's the balance, like where Krishna said, there is the divine being, from the divine being is born karma, from karma is born yajna, from yajna is born rains, from rain you get foods, from food you have all the beings benefiting from all of this. This entire sequence, all this very, very precarious balance is being referred to by Krishna, and he's saying that this is a process, right? This is going to go on. Whether I perform karma yoga or I come into it and do my actions in the right way, or I choose akarma, I choose to not do my actions, or I choose to do my actions with the attitude of yajna, it is up to me. I come into this picture, and Krishna says, this is a balance, and this is a wheel which has been set into motion. And whoever does not follow this particular balance, who does not fit himself or herself into this balance which has been created, is endangering themselves, right? You are ending up doing the wrong thing in the process. So this is a very, very beautiful explanation that Krishna has given. In fact, in the verses to come, he's going to say that how when even the Supreme Lord takes a human form, he steps into this balance, he steps into this wheel of different sequence of events, and even he follows this, right? And that's what Krishna is going to say in the next few verses, but that's for the next week. So thank you, dear listeners, for joining me. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's Lotus Feet. And I'll join you all again next week for the continuation of the third chapter. If you have anything that you'd like to convey to me, be it a question, be it something that I said and you do not agree with, feel free to write to me. You can always write to our feedback mail, listener@radiosai.org. If you have a question that's more personal of nature, you can always write to me to my personal mail ID, prem@radiosai.org. If you have any questions based on what was said, which is not clear, feel free to write to me. I think if it is beneficial to all the other listeners, I would be happy to discuss that on the show itself. But till I meet you all again next week at 7:30 p.m., take care. Sai Ram. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Bishu for the last segment of the day, the Vahini Satsang.
listening to Radio Sai Thursday Live. Stay tuned.